First case this morning is Lees v. Postal Service. Ms. Zwack.
Good morning.
Proceed.
May it please the court. This case is an appeal of the MSPB's dismissal of a petition for enforcement of a final board order. The grounds for the appeal are procedural. By departing from the appropriate procedural standards, the board acted arbitrarily and capriciously and reached its determination without procedures required by law, rule, or regulation. I wish to first of all make clear that this case is not an appeal of a determination by the MSPB of whether or not the Postal Service conducted a RIF impacting Daniel Lees. That is a substantive determination that the
board... the administrative judge did not and could not compel a RIF, right?
No, I'm sorry. The administrative judge decided the issue that Daniel Lees' position had been abolished. No, an administrative judge doesn't have the power to compel
there
a RIF.
But is that what you're seeking now? What does your client really seek as a remedy?
We seek compliance with the board's first compliance order.
Which stated that
in order to comply with the underlying remedial order, the Postal Service was required to release Daniel Lees from his competitive level. The board found that it was no longer an option to reassign Mr. Lees to his former position because that position had been permanently abolished. That was a finding of the board that the Postal Service never appealed. The merits of that decision are not before this court. The Postal Service never appealed.
Didn't the Postal Service comply completely with that by restoring him to his position and paying him what he was paid before?
Restoring Mr. Lees to his former position was not an option of the board's compliance order. The board's compliance order of August 6, 2004, adopted the ALJ's initial recommendation regarding compliance, finding that restoration was no longer a possibility. The position no longer existed.
The administrative judge says, if there is no longer a need for such a position, why didn't the record show that the Postal Service just decided that they would determine that there was a continuing need and place him back in his position?
There was a second determination by the board that became a final unappealed board order that was in August 6, 2004 that adopted the hearing examiner's recommendation that found that that position had been abolished. It was no longer a possibility to restore Mr. Lees to his former position because as the Postal Service itself had argued
Could you show me
certainly
where it says expressly that his position no longer exists and that...
Certainly.
At that point, what would happen to him? He has no position. He wasn't removed.
At the appendix at page 6 is the August 6, 2004 final order.
Yes.
And this order, as it says, the recommendation which found the agency in noncompliance with the board's final decision of March 13, 2002, and required the agency to formally release the appellant from his competitive level, effective the date of the abolishment, etc., now becomes the final decision of the Merit Systems Protection Board. That recommendation, Your Honor, is at page 80 of the appendix.
And that decision says that the position no longer existed and that he had to be released.
That's correct. At page 81, because the appellant's position no longer existed, the agency could not return him to that position.
So the decision that's on review here, your contention is inconsistent with that earlier compliance decision at page 80.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor.
So why is that fatal to what the board is doing here?
The board reopened the merits at this second...
They reopened the compliance decision.
That was a final decision. That decision, too, had never been appealed.
Don't they have some discretion to reopen, you know, when there's compliance going on, don't they have some discretion to reopen it and change their mind?
Well, their own cases say that they apply the law of the case. And we might also argue that this was res judicata at the point. At that point, the Postal Service never appealed that determination. It was closed. Therefore, a second compliance decision, the only factual question that the postal, that the board should have asked at that point is, did the Postal Service release Blias from his competitive level? Not, was there an abolishment? That was a determination that was made two decisions ago in March 13th, 2002.
Was there a change in his employment status, and what was it?
The Postal Service introduced information that his personnel form had never been changed. So on paper, no, there wasn't a change. In
was
reality,
there any change in his employment status? Was he demoted? Was he somehow, was his salary cut? What is it that brings you before us now as a cause of action against the agency?
The cause of action is against the procedural decision by the MSPB to ignore its own procedural standards, which require it not to reopen factual determinations. The factual determination is that Mr. Blias was abolished. That's not before this court. Nobody appealed that.
Let me ask you, if I could, what would be the practical effect of a ruling in Mr. Blias' favor? Because as Judge Rader indicated, it does appear, if you look at the material at 126 and 127 and following of the joint appendix, it does appear, number one, that he's never been demoted, and number two, he's never been reduced in pay. So what, putting it in blunt terms, no harm, no foul, what's the problem here?
Well, the harm here is that Mr. Blias' position no longer exists, no matter what it says on paper. And if the Postal Service initiated RIF procedures, then it's our belief that Mr. Blias would qualify for a discontinued service annuity, which is offered to an employee where, for example, the Postal Service would have to offer him another level 7 position within 50 miles of his duty station.
That's a RIF. You want a RIF, don't you? And then he'd have reassignment rights, and he could bump somebody else off, and isn't that what you're looking for?
We are looking for a RIF because that's a release from
but
this
you
competitive
can't, but
level.
But the administrative judge cannot order an agency to RIF.
The MSPB found that the agency did RIF Mr. Blias, and they RIFed him but did not allow him the protections of RIF procedure. They abolished his position. That's a final determination that's been made, has never been appealed.
Where did it find that there was a RIF?
In the initial decision, they found that in March 2002, which was the underlying order.
But what's happened here is that there's a dispute about the board's jurisdiction for the reasons that Judge Rader has expressed, right? That the two board members disagreed about whether there was board jurisdiction because the change in duties, in the view of Member Marshall, wouldn't constitute a RIF. Right? Am I remembering it correctly?
You are remembering. Well, jurisdiction was not properly before the board at
Well,
that
I understand,
point.
But it was a
disagreement between the two members sitting on the board at the time. But because there were only two members, and Member McPhee agreed that the question of jurisdiction had been finally decided and was not before the board,
normally a change in duties wouldn't constitute a RIF as long as there was no change in grade or pay, right?
Well, Mr. Blias was put in level 4 duties. The administrative judge looking at that.
No, but my question is, forget this case for a moment. As a general matter, a RIF does not occur as long as the employee continues in the same grade and pay, right? Even though the duties are changed.
This court has so ruled in Hayes, yes.
Right. So what we have here is a situation in which the only thing that's been changed for this employee is the duties, right?
That is correct. His duties have changed.
So what you're really arguing is that even though the board made a mistake the first time around in finding this was a RIF because of the change in duties, the board, as Chairman McPhee argued, should stick with that jurisdictional determination.
That's exactly what we are arguing, Your Honor. Yes, and that determination, a determination of jurisdiction based on facts which have not been reviewed, is generally not open to collateral attack later on in a defensive posture such as this. I repeat again, the Postal Service has never appealed any of these determinations. And as the Supreme Court has held in a contempt proceeding, the factual and legal determinations of the order that a party is claiming has been disobeyed are not up for reconsideration in a contempt proceeding. The sole question is, did you or did you not comply? The sole factual question for an agency in a compliance decision is, did you or did you not comply?
In the second compliance decision here, it does appear, you may be correct, that the government cannot challenge the jurisdictional issue, because even though it was jurisdictional, there does seem to be authority for the proposition that res judicata would bar the attack. But as I understood it, the government came forward in the second compliance proceeding and presented material showing that Mr. Galese had always been in this position and had never had a reduction in pay and had never been demoted, as Judge Rader was indicating. And they presented this evidence, and again, I think it's, 126, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I have it wrong, but it's the material that's at 126 and 127 in the appendix. Doesn't that constitute evidence that they could look at?
This was old evidence. If you look to page 54 of the appendix, this is a stipulation that the parties put before the administrative law judge in December 2001, before there was ever any determination on this case. The Postal Service says at, I guess it's the third bullet point down.
Let me just catch up. You're going to page 54?
54 in the appendix.
Okay.
This is a joint stipulation from December 2001 put before the ALJ, before any decision was made. The agency continues to maintain the appellant as a postal data source technician on his PS Form 50. Above that, in the first bullet point, it says the agency abolished the appellant's level 7 position. So here, both parties have stipulated that the Postal Service didn't change the paperwork, but they still abolished the position.
You're saying that even though this material that I was looking at at 126 and 127 wasn't presented until 04, that nevertheless is at variance with the previous stipulation. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying it's exactly the same as the previous stipulation. The new evidence that's presented says we never changed his Form 50. He's been in this same position since 1990. Well, they've already said that from the beginning. This is nothing new here. They've also already said that he was abolished. And the board in November 2004, reaches a determination that because his Form 50 wasn't changed, he wasn't abolished. That's contrary to evidence that was before the ALJ at the outset. So this is a reconsideration of old evidence to reach a new factual determination to dismiss a petition for enforcement.
Do you wish to save your rebuttal time, Ms. Lent?
Yes, I do. I have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Carl.
Good morning, Your Honor. This rather simple case has become a thicket of problems, and I think the quickest way to work through them is to look at the two orders that are essentially before you. The first is Acting Chairman McPhee's order, the one appealed from.
And which one is that?
That would be the order appealed from is the last order of the board. I guess it's about page 2 of the of the appendix.
Okay. That's the one that's on appeal now.
That is the one for you, in which you have to decide whether it was arbitrary and capricious. In that decision, Chairman McPhee found that the AJ ordered the agency to cancel a reassignment of the appellant from his former position. It then looked at the evidence before him, and I'll explain why he could in a minute, and found that the agency had complied. It had canceled the reassignment and was therefore in compliance.
Now, but there is an inconsistency between the recent decision and the initial compliance decision. The initial compliance decision found that the position had been abolished and ordered that he be treated, given his RIF rights. And this recent decision says, basically, no, the position hasn't been abolished. He's been restored to his original position. So there is an inconsistency, right?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Well, how is that?
When you look at the initial decision originally, the AJ was not focusing on the abolishment of the position.
The initial decision,
the decision that set all this off, the decision in which we were ordered to either reinstate him or
no, but I'm talking about the initial compliance decision. In the initial compliance decision, the board said the position's been abolished. Now the board is saying it hasn't been abolished, it can be restored to its original position. That's not consistent, right?
Only if you give the initial decision an odd sort of a meaning that doesn't fit the context.
Where do I find that initial decision?
The initial decision was probably about page, I think it was around page 7 of the appendix. No, I'm sorry, that is the split decision.
That's the split decision.
And it'll follow there. It will follow.
That's the initial compliance decision on page 7, right?
Your Honor, it would help me a lot if I could explain to you the context in which these orders were made, because the AJ, and on the first decision, thought the issue was something different than what is being portrayed here. In the initial decision, you know from the, I'm talking about the original decision.
I understand that the board may be entitled to change its mind. It may be that the board never had jurisdiction over this in the first place. I'm just trying to understand that there is a conflict here between the initial compliance decision and the second compliance decision, which is the fourth. It seems to me that's perfectly clear. What am I missing?
Well, that's what I'm trying to explain, Your Honor.
Okay.
And to do that, I have to go back to what the AJ, you know from the AJ's citation to the Glennon position, he never meant to say, he couldn't have meant to, the board's Glennon position, he couldn't have meant to say that the Postal Service can't restore the man to his old position. He said, what he said originally was that the Postal Service is arguing that it can demote a man, it can demote an employee, hold them in a new position and avoid RIF procedures by keeping them at a saved rate of pay. That was his position. He was focusing on the fact that we had demoted, he thought, we had taken the petitioner out of his original level and put him in a new one.
I'm sorry, this is not helping me understand how the initial compliance decision and the second compliance decision are consistent. The initial compliance decision said, job's been abolished, he has to be released. Second compliance decision says, position hasn't been abolished, it can be restored to. Those aren't consistent.
I'm telling you, no, Your Honor, he didn't say the job has been abolished. He has to be released.
Well, how do you explain the language on page 81 of the appendix?
I'm sorry, 81?
Yeah. He says the appellant's position no longer existed, the former position no longer existed. He said it twice.
I'm saying it because I think his concern is also shown on 81. He says, and I'm reading from the second paragraph down, the third line, he's concerned that the agency had taken no formal action to rescind the appealed action, to rescind the demotion. This has gotten off on the wrong start because everyone is reading the initial decision as a finding that eliminating the job was a demotion. And that's not what the AJ meant to say. He said an actual demotion is a demotion. Then we came back for the initial compliance decision. In the initial decision, he says, look, if you put the guy in a level 7 position, if you put him in a level in a level 4 position, you've demoted him. We come back and we say for the initial compliance decision, we didn't put him. He said, all right, Judge, we've redone it, we've given him level 7 duties. He says, no, I want a formal action. You can't, that was the focus of the
state. Let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
Let's assume that there is an inconsistency between the first and the second compliance decisions as the petitioner argues. Let's just assume that hypothetically.
Yes, sir.
What are your arguments as to why the board should be
If consent? There is an inconsistency, the first argument is that under 5 CFR 1201.118, the board can revise, has retained the power to review its own decisions. Our second set of arguments, assuming this inconsistency applies, exists, and I really would like to return to that, Your Honor, that the law of the case doesn't preclude reexamination of the decision. For one thing, it's discretionary. For another, this court was told in Colt Industries Operating Corp. By the Supreme Court that it had done the correct thing in not applying the law of the case to a jurisdictional problem. If the board said restoring a man to his old position is not enough, putting him at his old level is not enough, it exceeded its jurisdiction.
And I would have thought you would be arguing that the board said that we have an obligation independently to determine the board's jurisdiction, and that a change in duties is not something within the board's jurisdiction with respect to a writ.
I was going to make four arguments, Your Honor, and that's the second. The first is the board was not arbitrary or capricious in reexamining its jurisdiction. It had to do it unless the jurisdictional question was vague. Secondly, as Your Honor anticipated, there's no way the board can bind this, especially an AJ, can bind this court. This court has to decide whether or not to order the board to, in this case, to exceed its jurisdiction. I don't see how law of the case can do that, especially in a case like this, where the lack of jurisdiction is so clear. And for that, we rely on Christensen. It's not a close question.
I'm looking at the original decision of Judge Miller, the administrative judge. This isn't the compliance order. This is the original decision. And he says, if there is no longer a need for such a position, this is the order, the actual, what he's telling the agency. The agency may detail the appellant to another position. Well, that if clause says that if there's no longer a need, it also presupposes that if there is a need, they can keep him in his present position, right?
Our reading exactly, Your Honor.
So even if the position was somehow abolished, the administrative law judge said, you can still put him back in the position, of course, and then you don't have to go through a writ procedure. Isn't that exactly what happened here?
That is exactly what happened.
And so there's no inconsistency, really. The finding that the position was abolished, whether it was accurate or not, happened before the agency complied with the order by replacing him in his position. There's no reduction in grade or pay, and we're all kind of getting a little exercised over a conflict that doesn't exist.
Thank you.
Am I seeing that right?
That is our position exactly. That is what I was trying, inartfully, I think, to make the point.
But I'm not understanding. There certainly is no conflict with the original decision here, Judge Rader has pointed out. But there is a conflict between this compliance decision and the original compliance decision, isn't there?
No, sir. The original compliance decision rested on the fact that we had previously demoted the man and offered no formal evidence that we reinstated him. We had just come back and say, Your Honor, according to the compliance decision, we had come back and said to the board, we've informally given him level 7 duties. And the AJ, and more particularly the split board, that part which sided with the AJ, thought that wasn't enough. If we had demoted him, we had to formally put him back. The next time around, we came back with formal proof that he had not been demoted. And then the board was apparently content with the position, with what I think Judge Rader has just seen, that this is all a quibble, all an argument over nothing. The AJ had cited case law, which made it clear he thought we were entitled to return the man to his original position. When the board got the proof that we had returned the man to his original position, it said, that's it. And if there's a fault, if there's any fault to ascribe to us, it's twofold. First, we didn't explain clearly that the man was grandfathered into the abolished position in the first place. And second, at the initial compliance decision, we tried to proceed on informal evidence, affidavits saying, well, we've given them level 7 duties. If the original order that we had demoted them to a level 4 was correct, the informal statement that, well, we've given them level 7 duties was not adequate. We had to come back, as we did the third time around, with the official documentation showing the man had never left a level 7 position. If you ascribe any other meaning to the situation, you have to assume that the AJ didn't understand the very law he was citing and didn't understand this court's case law. I cannot see how, when you look at it in context, you can think that the AJ really meant to say that if you abolish a position but grandfather someone into it until you can find someone else for him, that's a violation of the law. If that's what the AJ meant, if the court imputes that meaning to the AJ, then I think it has to say it's not bound by the AJ's mistake and the board exceeded its jurisdiction. Your Honor, I don't have anything more to say. If the court has no further questions, I'll rest.
Thank you, Mr. Carl. Ms. Black. We have a little over 2 minutes remaining.
I'd reserve 5 minutes, I think. Did I use
it? You consumed some of your...
Oh, did I? Okay. Perfect. Thank you. The one point I wish to make right now is that the Postal Service's argument that the position was not abolished or that was somehow a mistake is completely disingenuous, because it was the Postal Service who has argued all along, and I quote, the agency has a compelling interest for not restoring the appellant to his former position because it no longer exists. It is undisputed that the appellant's former position was abolished May 18, 2001 as the result of the implementation of the time and attendance system. Therefore, the agency cannot restore to the appellant to a position which does not exist. The Postal Service has consistently argued that this position does not exist.
Is he working at the same pay and the same grade?
He's working at the same pay and the same grade.
Is he listed as being in the same position?
On paper, he is. He's sitting on his hands. He's not doing anything.
You haven't alleged a constructive removal here, have you? So you're not saying he's...
We didn't need to, because the board has twice found that he was abolished.
So he's in the same position, he's getting the same pay, he's at the same grade. What do you want us to do?
We want him to be released from his competitive level, because that's what the board twice determined.
He doesn't want his
job.
He'd
been abolished.
He doesn't want his job.
He doesn't really have a job right now. He's sitting
on
his hands.
No, we've already established. He has a job, he's in the same, getting the same pay, he's at the same grade.
He wants to be released from his competitive level.
He doesn't want
to
work.
Because that would qualify him for a discontinued service annuity.
Let me ask you this. How would he be entitled to a discontinued service annuity if he's always been employed and always been paid?
Because if the Postal Service released him from his competitive level, as it has been ordered to do, then the Postal Service would be required to offer him a level 7 position within 50 miles of his duty station, or release him. And if he was released, then he could be free to file an application with OPM for a discontinued service annuity. We don't believe that there is a level 7 available. If there is, then he would be happy to take it.
But why? I just don't understand why he wants to do that.
Because he's not doing anything right now. They don't have any work for him. He goes there and he sits and he does nothing. And for him, he'd rather be retired and sitting at home doing nothing, because there is no work. The work has been replaced by technology. So I see my time is up. I don't want to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Black. The next case is Chapman Law Firm Corporation versus the United States.
Essentially, what we're asking the court to do is overrule the Court of Federal Claims' assertion that it was not arbitrary and capricious for the contracting officer in that matter, in that procurement, to rely on, for HUD to rely on an offeror's assertion of intent to comply with the subcontracting limitation clause in the RFP in the face of clear statements in the offeror's proposal that it could not or would not comply with that limitation. Essentially, we have a contract that is set aside for small businesses. It's undisputed that the RFP contained the subcontracting limitation clause, which is FAR 52.219-14, which requires that a contractor who wins such a set-aside contract perform at least 51% of the total contract effort. And it's also undisputed that the technical evaluation panel, in initially looking at the offeror's proposal, said we can't determine whether you're going to comply with this rule or not. And there became a lot of back and forth between the offeror and the government for the offeror attempting to assure the government that they were going to comply. And in the end, the offeror says, yes, I'm going to comply. However, at the same time, further on in their final proposal revision, they're stating that they're going to need a waiver of certain Small Business Administration rules if they don't get a particular type of mentor protege program in place. Now, obviously, you don't ask for a waiver of something unless you consider yourself in violation of it. And just based on that, the contracting officer or the technical evaluation panel should have realized they could not rely on the blanket assertion, we're going to comply. Similarly, the offeror's initial operating costs, which demonstrate quite explicitly that the subcontractor was going to perform more than 51%, close to 59% of the labor effort on this contract. And as the Court of Federal Claims has stated, in a recent case called Transatlantic Lines LLC versus United States of America, it's 68 Federal Claims, 48, it's a 2005 case from last
September. Mr. Joe, sort of, what is the status of the contract right now?
The contract that was awarded to HMBI, the R4R, presumed is being performed. Now, it was initially stayed.
Right.
When we protested at the Government Accountability Office, I believe it was not stayed because the government, once we finished at the GAO, the automatic stay went out of place. The Court of Federal Claims initially held off performance for a period of time, but it has been performing since, the fall, or actually a year ago.
The fall of 04.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's been in place for a while.
It has, Your Honor. But that's the nature of that's why we like to win these things at the Government Accountability Office with the automatic stay, but it's the nature of the beast. It takes time to process these things.
But really, to rule in your favor, don't we have to, in essence, say that the government acted arbitrary, capriciously, without good reason, by relying on the representations and assurances that it had at the time, namely when it got the final proposal in response to the questions it sent out. Because it did send out a communication saying, look, we have a concern about your relationship with, what is it, who's the people, Allbest?
The Best Assets, Your Honor.
Best Assets, I'm sorry. We're concerned about this relationship. Are you going to comply with the contract? They come back, they point out that there's a provision in the contract that says, you know, that they'll comply and so forth. I mean, aren't you asking us to overturn that kind of a decision, and wouldn't that open up the door for a lot?
Not really, Your Honor, because I wholeheartedly agree that the contracting officer is not an inspector general whose job is to go out and pry through the interstices of a proposal. They're entitled to rely on the statements on the face of the proposal. However, what we have here is a general statement. We're going to comply with FAR 52.219-14. But within the same document, you have statements that utterly contradict that. One being this, that we're going to need a waiver of the limitation on the 50% rule.
It depends how you interpret those statements. If you interpret those statements as meaning we've got a problem during the first 6 months of performance, there's no inconsistency between the two. Isn't that correct?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because first of all, there's no waiver within the case law saying that, well, if you're not in compliance with the first 6 months,
no,
that's
but
okay.
Just try to answer my question.
Right.
If, in fact, those statements are interpreted to mean we're not going to comply during the first 6 months, but we'll comply with the contract overall, there's no problem here, right?
No, Your Honor, because one, you can't interpret their statement saying
no, but you're disagreeing with me about the interpretation. I'm saying accept that interpretation. There's no problem. There's no inconsistency. I know you disagree with that, right? you really do disagree with that. I understand it. But if the other statement is read as saying we're talking about the first 6 months, then there's no inconsistency.
There is an inconsistency, Your Honor, because there's not a... You can be in non-compliance in the first 6 months, but be in compliance in the latter 6 months. The contract is a meeting of minds between the two parties. The offeror has to meet all the material requirements in the RFP. One of the material requirements is the limitation on subcontracting. There are many instances where the RFP might say you have 6 months to comply with whatever, you have 90 days to comply with something else. In fact, in this RFP, there was particularly a 120-day transition period where not all the services were being performed. However, there is nothing to say that this limitation on subcontracting is something that's subject to some sort of transition period.
Yeah, but you're disagreeing with my hypothetical. My hypothetical is we reject that. We say this should be interpreted as applying only the first 6 months. If that's true, there's no inconsistency, right?
Your Honor, then you're overruling your own precedent.
Answer is there's no inconsistency. If it's interpreted that way, you don't want it. You say that's wrong, and I understand that.
I guess I don't understand the question, Your
Honor. The question is, hypothetically, if they said we're not going to comply for the first 6 months, that's not inconsistent with compliance for the entire contract period.
Then their proposal should be rejected for being non-compliant with the RFP, Your Honor. Within the federal procurement law, you cannot say, give me a pass for 6 months.
Well, Mr. DeSor, it's the contract as a whole. How long is it? What's the period of the contract?
Well, there's a base year and then option years after that, four option years, and there is no guarantee that any option year will be awarded.
No, I understand, but I mean, it's the whole period of the contract. I mean, it may be... Theoretically, there could be one pay period or something when someone is non-compliant, literally with the 50% requirement. But you have to don't you have to look at the whole the contract in total?
I would agree with you, Your Honor. If we had that situation where it was just a potential that maybe somebody quit, someone from Harrington, Moran, and Barksdale, the prime contractor, quit, and then the Best Assets person would have to maybe fill in. But that's a situation for administration of the contract. That's not something to do with formation of the contract. When we're talking about formation of the contract, we have to have a meeting of the minds between between the parties. The government says in its RFP, you must comply with this limitation. To allow someone within the body of their proposal to say, I'm not going to comply with this limitation, is to, one, give them an unfair advantage as to all the other
offers. But I don't know if they're saying that. They're not saying they're not going to comply. They said they will comply.
They will comply. That's the same thing as my son saying to me, Your Honor, I'm going to clean up my room. And then I know he also says, but I'm going out to play now. Your Honor, that if you can say I'm going to comply, but if you also say, particularly in your labor hour figures, which are the hard data.
Well, but if you say you're going to clean up the room, you have to clean up your room sometime this week, then if he goes out and plays today, he's not out of compliance.
That's if
he can do it tomorrow and still comply with your requirement, right?
If that's what the RFP is.
Isn't that what's going on here? They have to comply within the term of the contract. They don't have to comply tomorrow. They don't have to comply the next day. Sometime within the term of the contract, they must be under that 50%.
That is the point of the case law that talks about this being an administration of the contract issue. But my first principles is that if you say within your proposal, I cannot comply with this limitation, not limiting it to any time period, just saying I cannot comply with this limitation, I need a waiver of this 50% limit. It doesn't matter if in actual practice you're going to comply. The contracting officer has to live with what is stated in the proposal. I had reserved 5 minutes.
You want to save your rebuttal time?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Del Sordo. Mr. Haverbach?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to begin by addressing Mr. Del Sordo's assertion that HMBI had utterly contradicted its representation. It did not utterly contradict its representation that it would, in fact, comply with the limitation on subcontracting. Neither the allocation of costs nor its statement concerning its intent to seek a waiver of the mentor-protege agreement speak to the question, which is germane to this case, which is, as the court indicated, whether throughout the life of the contract, at least 50% of the cost of contract performance incurred for personnel shall be expended for employees of the concern. The relevant issue, as the court has discerned, is not whether in the first 30 days or the first 60 days, or I'm sorry, the first 90 days or the first 6 months of contract performance, whether or not cost would be 50% or greater, but rather over the full year.
But your argument is that this should be viewed as a six-month limitation because that was the only SBA requirement, right?
Your Honor, the SBA requirement is not actually part of this contract.
I understand, but isn't that your contention that the SBA is only concerned with the first 6 months? I thought that was the point you made.
The SBA regulation refers to 6 month increments,
yeah.
But for example, on page 1456 of the appendix where the HMBI made the statement, the question is being asked in the context of initial operating costs. And there's no statement that after the first 6 month period that we're going to need a waiver. But rather, in the context of what's being asked here is, we have a concern about your initial operating costs. What are you going to do about them? And the response is made that, in reference to the initial operating costs, we may need to seek a waiver. But by no means is that a suggestion that throughout the life of the contract, more than 50% of the labor costs would be incurred by the subcontractor. It's also important to point out that the first 90 days, which is the basis for the breakdown of costs, are not at all reflective of what has to be performed during the typical periods of the contract, particularly if one looks at the contract as one lasting over a period of years. There are a series of ramp-ups that take place during the first 120 days, such that the full effort of the contract, including the primary tasks for which HMBI is responsible pursuant to its subcontracting arrangement, don't really get started until either, depending on how one looks at it, 90 days or 120 days after the award. In, particular, the marketing activities for which HMBI is primarily responsible don't take place until after day 120. So it's certainly not surprising to find out that during the first 120 days, or the first 90 days, that a large portion of HMBI's costs won't have been accounted for during an explanation of its initial operating costs.
But this language they're relying on, page 13 of the blue brief, this is their primary guess. This is their primary reliance. The cost sheet, as you've shown, is explicitly only for the first 9 months or something like that.
90 days,
excuse me. But they say this language at the bottom, they quote at the bottom of page 13 of the blue brief, shouldn't be read as applying to the first 6 months of the contract, as you say it should, right?
That's my understanding of their argument,
right.
Yes.
So could you tell me again why we should read this statement as limited to the first 6 months?
The primary reason is that the statement from which they're quoting on page 13 appears in two places. There are two sets of final proposal revisions, but the statement is the same. And in each, the question being asked by HUD is under the caption, initial operating cost. And there's a question raised about the initial operating cost, and it's within that specific context that HMBI responds, we may need to seek a waiver. They are...
And what page does that appear in the appendix?
It appears on two pages. The one I have before me is 1456.
1456. Why does initial operating cost mean first 6 months?
Well, in fact, the initial operating cost, as it's referred to elsewhere, the question that HUD asked about was, in fact, the first 90 days, which will only be 3 months.
The first 90 days, yeah.
And HUD...
So you say this should be read as limited to the first 90 days?
I can't say that they necessarily put a pinpoint as to how long that period would last, but they were concerned that for the first six-month period, the accounting might come out such that more than 50% during the initial six-month period would be incurred by subcontractors. It's also, I think, important to note that the statement that HMBI makes isn't, we are going to need to do this. What it says is, if the SBA does not approve the mentor-protege relationship, HMBI will request permission from the SBA to exceed work requirement percentages for an SBA firm. Potentially, the permission could have been denied, and HMBI could have acted accordingly by rearranging what it needed to do. I think it's necessary.
Is there a distinction here between the limitation on subcontracting and the small business concerns? The small business, the SBA provisions, that's just a preference in the contracting. Is that correct? Whereas the limitation on the subcontracting is a requirement of the contract. It seems to me like Chapman here is trying to raise concerns that are relevant to its small business preference and import them over into the concerns about the contractual limit on subcontracting. Am I correct?
I think that's an entirely accurate understanding. It is not necessary for purposes of this contract for HMBI to comply with the 8A requirements and that whole body of jurisprudence.
That's just a preference. They get a preference if they hit the right small business numbers, right?
They would, although this speaks to the 8A requirements, and this is not actually an 8A set-aside. Such that it's only a small business set aside. And the regulation that's being referred to here relates, I believe, solely to an 8A set aside. So on some level, the court is entirely correct in suggesting that this isn't relevant because it's on the SBA side as opposed to on the contract side. But it's even more, if that could be the case, more irrelevant because it's not even an 8A set aside to begin with. The other thing that I think bears noting is that it's entirely appropriate to read the representation that HMBI makes concerning its anticipated initial operating costs in the context of and in accordance with its representation on the previous page that it intends to comply with the limitation on subcontracting. On page, I believe it's 1548, HMBI makes its representation that it plans to employ at least 50% of its personnel. HMBI management team will review total costs incurred on property on personnel quarterly to ensure that our employees are performing at least 50% of the costs expended. HMBI, Mr. Del Sordo has suggested that breakdown of cost to be incurred somehow contradict that, but I think a much more appropriate reading is to simply try to harmonize them and to give the HMBI the benefit of the doubt in suggesting that what it says on one page is consistent with the thing it says two paragraphs later. At a minimum, the contracting officer was not in any way, did not act arbitrarily or capriciously in trying to harmonize these two provisions, because the fundamental inquiry that the court needs to examine is whether or not it is clear on the face of the proposal that there is simply no way that HMBI can comply with the limitation on subcontracting. HMBI was in a position to comply with the limitation on subcontracting. It made the representation, and to suggest otherwise would place the contracting officer in a position where it needs to somehow try to predict the future and replace the government in the position of, if Mr. Del Sordo's position were correct, of deeming potential bidders not capable of performing long before they've been given a chance to do so. Such a ruling would, number one, create an insurmountable burden for the contracting officer, but number two, would subject the United States to all kinds of potential litigation concerning an improper disqualification prior to the time that the contractor had been given a chance. I have nothing further than that. If the court has any additional questions, I'm
happy to answer. Thank you, Mr. Auerbach. Del Sordo, you have more than 4 minutes. Again.
Thank you, Your Honor. We wholly agree that this 8A issue is irrelevant as to this contract, except to the extent that it shows HMBI's intention. We're not attempting to say that this was some sort of preference contract or that it was an 8A contract. The point is that HMBI made a mistake and assumed that there was some sort of 8A component to this contract. And in making that assumption, it made an admission that it was not going to be able to comply with the 50% rule. So whether the fact that they made it in the context of an 8A clause or something is irrelevant, except to the extent that it shows their intention. And that's what we're talking about here. They make a statement, we're going to review our operating costs every quarter to make sure that we're okay. But they say right there, we're not. If we don't get this mentor-protege thing, we're going to have to get a waiver of the 50%. Similarly, the only issue about the initial operating costs is that it is a window into the black box that is the relationship between the subcontractor and the contractor. The way the proposals were set up is that you didn't have to give your breakdown on your costs. However, in this one instance, the government asked the offeror, you know, your initial operating costs seem a little high. There was just a raw number that was given. So they break it down. And it's a simple arithmetic procedure to see that the subcontractor is because the fee that's being paid to them is X, the initial operating costs are Y, that it's more than 50%. Now, I understand it's only the first 90 days, but it is a ratio. It should tell the government something, that that the subcontractor is going to be doing more work than is appropriate. And I agree wholly, and everyone agrees, that the contracting officer is not tasked to pry into every nook and cranny of the proposal. But when there's something stated clearly on the face, and this is the GAO's precedent says this, and Judge Hewitt said it below, and also the Transatlantic Lines case repeated this, that the contracting officer is fully able to rely on a statement. However, if there's a contradiction, or if there's something clear on the face of the proposal that they are not going to comply with the limitation on subcontracting, that cannot form the basis for a successful work. Now, I understand Judge Schall's concern about the fact that a lot of water is flowing over the dam between here and now. Obviously, my client's preference would be that you overturn Judge Hewitt's decision, enter an injunction, require the contracting officer to do something further. However, in the alternative, we have asked for relief under the implied contract of fair dealing. There's also been proposal costs that could be rendered. And I bring up the implied contract of fair dealing because there does seem to be some sort of disagreement at the Court of Federal Claims whether that cause of action still exists. Between the Lion Raisins case and the Unified Architecture case, it would be helpful if this court would opine on whether that cause of action still exists at this point. However, just to sum up, Your Honors, the fact that someone states we're going to comply and it's contradicted 2 pages later or even somewhere else in their proposal cannot form the basis for a successful award, and we would ask you to overturn the Court of Federal Claims in this instance. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Del Sordo. The next case is Aero Products International Incorporated versus Intex Rep.